Good evening and welcome. Thank you for coming out tonight. My name is Mary Black-Juntinen. I'm the music librarian, and before that I was the music cataloger, and before that I was a student working for the music. And so my whole life at MSU has been involved with music. I was asked to spend a couple minutes talking about the music collections, which we moved over here in 1994 out of the music building. We are available to the public. We have over 14,000 cataloged CDs, over 7,000 records. We have over 100,000 scores and parts, and 40 or so thousand books. And all of those are available to anyone in the community or in the state. We also have some electronic resources, but those are somewhat limited according to your status as community or faculty members. If you have any questions, please, I'm always here. The Fine Arts Library is directly down the hall here. If you have not been there, stop in tonight and take a quick look if you like. We have music and art together in that location. And it's now my privilege to introduce Harlan Jennings, who came to Michigan State when I was an undergrad in choral ed, and I was a soprano voice major, and we have known each other in various capacities ever since. And he was a newly minted doctoral possessor when he first came and has been a baritone faculty member, has taught many, many, many students over the years, taught song literature, diction, repertoire, directed operas, sang in operas. We've been on the stage many times together in our local opera company when we had productions here for about 25 years. And so he has a wide range of experience, and he's always had this interest in the opera of the United States, and particularly the Midwest and West. So I hope you will enjoy his program this evening. We do have refreshments at the back of the room, which he has generously provided, and we'd ask that you enjoy those after the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary, for that fine introduction. Before we start, I would like to thank some people who made this event possible. These are the people who really control everything, and they can shut me down at any time tonight. The Cliff Hacca, Director of Libraries, Michael Rodriguez, Rick Pfeiffer, Paul Cooper, and John Shaw all helped make this event possible. Sunset, St. Louis. Hushed in the smoky haze of summer sunset, when I came home again from far-off places, how many times I saw my western city dream by her river. Then for an hour the water wore a mantle of tawny gold and mauve and misted turquoise under the tall and darkened arches bearing gray, high-flung bridges. Against the sunset, water towers and steeples flickered with fire up the slope to westward, and old warehouses poured their purple shadows across the levee. High over them, the black train swept with thunder, cleaving the city, leaving far beneath it wharf boats moored beside the old side wheelers, resting in twilight. I like to imagine that this Sarah Teasdale poem, though written 70 years after Jenny Lind's conquest of St. Louis, still captures much of the mid-19th century essence of that river city. And now we come to Jenny Lind and P.T. Barnum and their trip to St. Louis in March of 1851. This is a lithograph of Jenny Lind looking better than she ever did in real life. I'm sorry to say. It's dated 1847 and was produced in London by Richard J. Lane. We have it courtesy of the Library of Congress. At the St. Louis levee, early on a March morning in 1851, a rather plain, unpretentious woman in her early 30s stepped off a steamboat onto Missouri soil. Although it was only 5 a.m., a large crowd had gathered at the riverfront to catch a glimpse of the stranger who made her way through the onlookers to a waiting carriage. What was about to unfold was the most exciting musical event St. Louis had witnessed. In a series of 5 concerts in just 9 days, one of the most celebrated singers of all time would captivate the city. Charles G. Rosenberg, a British writer and editor who was a member of Lynn's entourage in 1851, described conditions in St. Louis on the day of Lynn's arrival. This is a quote. This morning the city was in one of its muddier phases. The sky was of that deep and fresh blue which most generally follows a day's rain. A sharp and brisk breeze swept down the streets. The roads were more than ankle deep in filth, for it had been raining very heavily for the last 24 hours. His overall impression of Missouri's most populous city? St. Louis is muddier in wet and drier in dry weather than any other part of the United States. When mud is in vogue, some of the streets are literally impassable. What Jenny Lynn thought about the condition of St. Louis streets is anyone's guess. Chances are that the diva, who had toured the English provinces and large parts of Northern Europe, took little notice of the mire. Regarding the onlookers at the levee, Lynn was astonished that so many people were on hand to meet her at each port of call, never realizing that one of P.T. Barnum's agents often telegraphed ahead regarding her approximate time of arrival. The illegitimate child of a schoolteacher, Lynn, born in 1820, spent a good part of her early years in foster homes, until, at the age of only 9, her already extraordinary talent won her admittance to the Royal Opera School in Stockholm. A mere 8 years later, at the age of 17, she made her operatic debut at the Stockholm Opera as Agata in Weber's Der Freischütz. Lynn's assumption of a variety of demanding roles, Pamina in Magic Flute, Don Anna in Don Giovanni, and the title roles in Lucia di Lammermoor and Norma, took a toll on her young throat. And in the summer of 1841, still only 20 years old, she went to Paris to ask the renowned vocal pedagogue Manuel Garcia the Younger to repair the damage. Garcia allegedly said to Lynn, quote, "Mademoiselle, you have an originality of style which requires training, but either your voice is worn or you never had one. You must take a few weeks of rest, after which I will hear you again." Garcia then gave her 10 months of lessons that restored her voice and provided her with a solid technique that apparently served her for the rest of her career. Lynn's greatest operatic triumph occurred 6 years later, May 1847, at Her Majesty's Theatre in London, where her debut before an audience that included Queen Victoria and Prince Albert created a sensation. 2 years later, she unexpectedly announced her decision to leave the operatic stage and devote herself to recitals and oratorio, and that she did for the rest of her life. Back in St. Louis, the advent of Jenny Lind had been eagerly anticipated for months. Slide of P.T. Barnum, courtesy of the State Historical Society in Columbia, Missouri. Under the management of American impresario P.T. Barnum, Lind had embarked the previous September on the most successful American tour of any artist up to that time. The partnership of Barnum and Lind was an unlikely one, however. Prior to hiring the soprano, Barnum had tried his hand at a variety of enterprises, but he had no experience in the management and promotion of classical musicians. Nor had he even heard her sing. Yet Barnum somehow divined that the American public was ripe for a Lynn tour, and then devised one of the most brilliant publicity campaigns in the annals of entertainment, marketing the singer as an emblem of feminine virtue and benevolence. By the time the soprano arrived stateside, the entire nation seemed possessed by Jenny Lind mania, as it was called in the newspapers. Here's New York Harbor, according to the Ladies' Home Journal, a sketch of Jenny Lind's arrival September 1st, 1850. An astonishing 20,000 onlookers gathered there on this September day to watch her come ashore. Thereafter, the Swedish nightingale created a furor wherever she sang, mesmerizing New York, Boston, Providence, and Philadelphia before sweeping south to conquer Baltimore, Washington, Richmond, Charleston, and Havana. Now we'll have a look at the terms of her contract with Mr. Barnum. She wound up giving 95 concerts under his auspices from September 1850 until the following June. In accordance with her wishes, Barnum hired composer-conductor Julius Benedict and baritone Giovanni Belletti as supporting artists. Benedict received $25,000 for the tour plus expenses. Now you need to multiply everything by 20. Belletti, $12,500 plus expenses. Lind herself was paid $1,000 per performance. In addition, Barnum agreed to, and this is a quote from the contract, furnish the said Jenny Lind with a servant as waiting maid and a male servant. He agreed to pay the expenses of a female companion. He agreed to pay also for a secretary to superintend her finances, to pay for all her travel expenses, and to place at her disposal in each city a carriage and horses with their necessary attendants. It was further stipulated that all travel would be first and best class. Given the hazards of mid-19th century travel in North America, Lind's reaching St. Louis was by no means assured. The southern leg of the tour nearly ended in disaster. En route from Wilmington, North Carolina to Charleston, South Carolina, the troupe encountered a severe storm at sea. We'll go back to this slide of New York Harbor. I really don't know what an ocean-going vessel looked like in those days, but maybe that's fairly close. Anyway, we have an account of this storm left in the memoirs of a passenger on this ship who was not a member of Jenny Lind's entourage. And he wrote this: "We left Wilmington about 3:30 on Sunday, the 22nd of December, 1850, with about 120 passengers, among them the Queen of Song and the King of Showmen. We were fairly out to sea about 8 p.m. when it commenced blowing, and by 10 o'clock the wind had increased to a perfect gale, which continued until nearly 4 o'clock the next morning with a very heavy sea. During the severest part of the storm, the rudder chain parted, and our boat headed round into the trough of the sea and very nearly capsized." Having grown up in landlocked Kansas, I don't know anything about sailing, but I imagine that you want to point your boat into the waves if you've got a heavy sea, so you ride up and down. And apparently what happened when this rudder chain broke, the boat turned around and then was in the trough and could very easily have been swamped and overturned by the next wave. Anyway, she made it to Charleston, and then later she made it to Havana without incident. And in early February 1851, Lind and her entourage sailed from Havana across the Gulf of Mexico to New Orleans, an uneventful voyage of just 4 days. Remaining a month in the Crescent City, the Nightingale gave no fewer than 12 concerts, grossing the highest total of the entire tour, save for New York City. From New Orleans, Barnum dispatched northward 2 advance agents, to make preparations for Lynn's engagement in St. Louis. One of them was Saul Smith. And there he is. You can see he did a lot of things in his career, but he was certainly a kingpin in St. Louis theatrical circles and also in New Orleans. Smith was manager not only of the St. Louis Theater, but also of the St. Charles Theater in New Orleans, where Lynn's concerts were being held in February 1851. One of Smith's responsibilities in St. Louis was the selection of an appropriate venue. The newly constructed 2,500-seat Bates Theater seemed an obvious choice. However, the famous actress Charlotte Cushman had already booked the Bates for the dates in question. When the Bates management asked for $750 per night, $500 for the hall, plus Cushman's vacating fee of $250, Barnum's representatives decided to look elsewhere. Eventually, they chose Wyman's Hall, across from the old courthouse, site of the Dred Scott trials of 1847 and 1850. Here's an engraving of Dred Scott, courtesy of the Library of Congress, is from Century Magazine, 1887. Remember, he sued for his freedom on the basis of his having lived in free states. Well, what was actually part of Wisconsin territory, I believe, Illinois and Wisconsin. And he lost his first suit in St. Louis, but then the judge threw that out, discerning that some of the testimony was hearsay, and it was retried 3 years later. And this time a jury, this time he won, but then it was overturned 2 years later by the Missouri Supreme Court. And then later, when his original master died, according to Missouri law, the ownership of slaves then reverted to his owner's wife's brother, who lived in New York State. So Scott sued again on the basis of probably of New York's being a slave-free state. And this eventually made its way to the Supreme Court, and where he lost the case in a very famous Supreme Court case in 1857. Wyman's Hall housed businesses on the ground floor, an auditorium with excellent acoustics on the second floor, and a high school for boys on its upper floors. The major drawback to Wyman's Hall was the limited size of the auditorium, which could hold only 700 people. Smith solved this problem by ordering the construction of a temporary balcony that expanded the total capacity of the hall to 1,100 seats, so he boosted it by 400. It probably wouldn't be up to code in today's world. They wouldn't get away with it. All these preliminaries were a matter of public knowledge and occasioned considerable comment in the press, not all of it complimentary. Here we have two quotes from the Missouri Republican, which was the leading newspaper in St. Louis at this time. The first quote is an editorial from March 9th. "By an advertisement in our columns this morning, it will be seen that Jenny Lynn will give four concerts." That's the way it was originally announced. She wound up giving five. "Wyman's Hall has been engaged. We regret that a more capacious room could not be provided for the occasion. Application, we understand, was made for use of several of the churches, but rejected in every instance." And here's the Republican on March 15th. "Everybody who wishes to hear her should have an opportunity to do so at a fair price. But the fault is not with Mr. Barnum or his agents. It rests with our own citizens who have failed to provide a hall or room of sufficient capacity for such entertainments. It is a reproach to the wealth and landed interests of our city that we have not a place capable of accommodating more than about 1,500 persons." End of quote. Harsher words came from a private citizen who feared that Wyman's limited capacity would necessitate ticket sales and ticket prices beyond the means of the common man. And here's his letter to the editor of the Republican. Quote, We are forced to conclude that but a few of our citizens will be able to hear the Swedish Nightingale. It seems unjust and unpardonable. I would suggest that a meeting of the citizens be called at some public place where this matter can be examined. Without intending to reflect upon the agents who have perpetrated this outrage, the writer must believe that there has been something wrong, or else the room would have been selected, which would have accommodated the largest number of persons. End of the quote from that letter. At the last minute, theater manager James W. Bates joined this public debate in an attempt to garner the last word, at least in print. And he wrote this letter to the editor of the Republican, which was published. Upon Mr. Saul Smith's application from my theater for the Lynn concerts, I told him that Mr. Barnum could have it for $500 per night, but that, having entered into an engagement with Miss Cushman, it would also be necessary for him to pay that lady for surrendering those nights justly her own, but which she had kindly consented to forego for the sum of $250 per night. My theater, with the consent of Miss Cushman, is still at Mr. Barnum's disposal. On these terms, which terms I have no fear in submitting to the impartial judgment of the inhabitants and visitors of St. Louis, very obediently yours, James W. Bates. This drew the following retort from Saul Smith, published a day later by the Republican. I'll put another slide of Mr. Smith up there. And he said, I did not make application for Mr. Bates' theater at all. I did ask the terms, but I do not remember his saying anything of her having kindly consented to anything. He viewed her offer at that time as a matter of business, and so did I. I have never yet complained of the sum demanded. Mr. B. had a perfect right to set any price he pleased upon his own house, and I conceive that I had the same right to decline taking it, without complaint being made for the exercising of that right. In relation to the last paragraph of Mr. Bates' card, I think he may make his mind quite easy, inasmuch as there is not the slightest prospect of his house being wanted. Needless to say, Barnum remained steadfast in his original choice of venue. After 4.5 weeks in New Orleans, Lynn and her entourage boarded the steamer Magnolia March 10th and steamed up the Mississippi River toward St. Louis, pausing en route to give performances at Natchez, where the citizenry had raised a guarantee of $7,000, which Barnum required, and Memphis. On March 15th, 5 days after leaving New Orleans, they reached the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers at Cairo, Illinois. Here they transferred from the Magnolia to the Lexington, which had come down from the Ohio River, for the last leg of the journey to St. Louis. And here's Jenny Lind in 1850. This is courtesy of the State Historical Society of Missouri. In 1851, there were no railroads in Missouri. Steamboat travel, the most convenient and rapid means of transportation then available in the interior of America, was a dangerous business. Although Miss Lind would have occupied the richly furnished cabin section for ladies at the rear of the second deck, thereby avoiding many of the hardships suffered by other passengers, she still traveled at considerable risk. Most passengers through the 1860s traveled on the less expensive lower deck, where slaves in transit, farmers, artisans, and immigrants shared space with the freight and engines. Conditions on the lower level were often hazardous. When steam boilers exploded, which was not that infrequently, or fires broke out, deck passengers and crew members suffered most of the injuries and deaths. Inadequate sleeping, eating, or sanitation facilities promoted the spread of disease. As a result, deadly cholera epidemics often traveled with deck passengers to cities along the rivers, including St. Louis. But Jenny Lind didn't catch it, and apparently Nobody in on her team did either, luckily. The thriving city that Lind entered March 17, 1851, boasted a population topping 80,000, eighth largest in the nation at the time. Here's a slide of St. Louis of approximately 1859, courtesy of the Library of Congress, a rather fanciful depiction, I would say, of St. Louis at this time. Despite its size and prosperity, St. Louis still evinced certain aspects of its frontier past. The city always had suffered from a drainage problem, and over the years, its sinkholes and ponds had become odoriferous cesspools, hazards to the public health. City streets, many of which were unpaved, remained in a deplorable state of repair. Deeply rutted, impossibly muddy in wet weather, and strewn with waste and garbage. And the 2 days of incessant rain that preceded the Nightingale's arrival undoubtedly exacerbated these conditions. By 1850, the city finally had approved a measure to build and maintain a public sewer system, but it was not yet operational. An editorial in the Republican, published a mere 5 months prior to Lynn's arrival, revealed another facet of St. Louis life at variance with its image as a center of culture and gracious living. This, as I said, is an editorial in the Republican. Several persons have called upon us in reference to the manner in which butchers and others drive cattle through the streets, especially in thronged avenues. For some reason, as soon as a drove of cattle has landed on the wharf, the drivers put them to the top of their speed and rush them through the streets in total disregard of the men, women, and children that are passing. Serious accidents have resulted from this practice, and we trust the city council at their next session will provide a suitable punishment. Faced with a demanding schedule, Lind wished, naturally, to keep to herself as much as possible, especially the night before the opening. But on the evening of March 17th, she was obliged to attend a reception given by the local Polyhymnia Society. The group serenaded Lind and was about to present her with an honorary membership in the organization when a number of uninvited guests barged into the room and so disrupted the proceedings that it was impossible to continue. As a result, the presentation was delayed for 48 hours, till after the first concert. Following a practice Barnum had instituted at the beginning of the tour, tickets for reserved seats were auctioned off prior to each performance. Any remaining seats were then put up for sale at the box office for $5, the modern equivalent of approximately $100. The initial auction took place at 10 a.m. March 17th at Wyman's Hall. Admission was 10 cents, with the proceeds going to various charities. E.A. Byron, the proprietor of a saloon located next to Bates Theater, purchased the first ticket at the auction for $150. That's $3,000 today. And by the way, the highest bid for the entire Lind tour occurred in Providence, Rhode Island. That was $650, and that's the equivalent of $13,000 in today's money. By curtain time the following night, March 18th, the area surrounding Wyman's Hall was jammed with people. This is a quote from the Republican. Long before the doors were open, a crowd began to gather on the street near Wyman's Hall, and by the time the concert hour had arrived, the street, the courtyard opposite, and several adjacent avenues were crowded with thousands of persons. It was with difficulty that the holders of tickets managed to force their way through to the hall. What they didn't say was that people were all over the roofs of adjacent buildings also. The hall itself was sold out. Chairs were set up in the aisles and then offered at $5 each, the same price as regular seats. Again, that's $100 apiece. When these went, all available standing room, priced at $4, was sold off. but many people were still turned away. Now we'll take a look at the opening night program. Lynn's listeners heard a program that featured no fewer than five selections from her debut concert in New York City, September 11th, 1850. And these pieces are, I've got little red asterisks there. I don't know if you can see them or not. Sorgete, Sorgete from Maometto Secondo by Rossini. That was a solo by the baritone Belletti. The next one was a duet, though, Belletti and Jenny Lynn. That's item five, Per Piacere alla Signora from Il Turco in Italia, also an opera by Rossini. In the second half, Figaro's aria from the Barber of Seville, Belletti's chance in the spotlight, of course. Then a trio for voice and two flutes with Jenny Lind and the two flautists, names of Kyle and Zita. This is from Meyerbeer's opera, A Camp in Silesia. This is known as a gypsy song. Much of this music Meyerbeer later used in probably revising a bit in his L'Etoile du Nord, the Star of the North, an opera that came later. And the last thing that was also on the debut concert in New York that the St. Louisans got to hear was a Swedish melody played by Linda at the piano. And the important thing about this is that her acting in this manner, sitting down at the piano and singing this Swedish folk song while accompanying herself, inaugurated in America a crowd-pleasing practice that would be copied by many a prima donna down through the decades. The soprano was supported by baritone Giovanni Belletti. We have a slide of him, courtesy of the State Historical Society of Missouri. Violin soloist Joseph Burke, the two solo flutists whom we mentioned earlier, and an orchestra of perhaps 20 players conducted by Julius Benedict. And here's a sketch of him, which looks, which bears a suspicious similarity to the sketch of Mr. Belletti, but never mind that. Now we'll, here's a breakdown of Lynn's orchestra. It consisted of a core traveling ensemble of at least 10 instrumentalists and was augmented at each port of call by local musicians. So the 10 core instruments, as you can see, are two violins, a cello and bass. She had two flutes, an oboe and clarinet, and horn and trumpet. And wherever they could pick up qualified musicians, they would augment the orchestra a bit. I'm not sure how complicated this made the rehearsals, but it certainly complicated them to a certain extent, working in the new people. The morning after the first performance, there was a brisk business at the ticket office. I should have said the ticket auction for concert number two. Most seats sold for $7 to $9. That's $140 to $180 in today's money. The day saw Jenny Lind hucksterism in full flower. Melville's store was advertising Jenny Lind hats. Jenny Lind flour was being manufactured. And the Republican notified the citizenry that Mrs. Otto Heimbuch had erected a bust of Jenny Lind which could be seen at Weber's on 4th Street. The likeness is said to be remarkable. The second concert, which featured Alice's Romanza from Meyerbeer's Robert le Diable, Casta Diva from Bellini's Norma, and Perché non ho del vento from Donizetti's Lucia, drew even better than the first, bringing in almost $8,000. It was Lynn's 62nd concert of the tour. And now, just for fun, we'll go back to this slide of Jenny in 1850. Once again, a large crowd mobbed the area outside Wyman's Hall. The Republican, in its review of the second concert, deemed Lynn's singing exempt from criticism of any kind. In fact, such was the ensorcelant effect of the Nightingale's voice this particular evening that the reviewer found himself transported to another world. And here's part of his review. When she ceased singing, we felt as if we had been lifted from the earth and were in our spirit, soaring on those faded accents into the realms above. On the afternoon of Friday, March 21st, it's following the second concert, the Butchers of St. Louis staged a parade. Resplendent in white shirts, blue scarves, and black pants, down the city streets they marched, 40 to 50 strong, accompanied by a small band of instruments and preceded by 5 cartloads of fresh beef. As they reached the avenue beneath Lynn's rooms at the Planner's House Hotel, the diva appeared on her balcony, eliciting several hearty cheers from the butchers and onlookers alike. Miss Lynn bowed several times in acknowledgement of the compliment, and the procession passed on. Earlier in the week, a number of prominent St. Louisans had asked Barnum to deliver one of his trademark temperance lectures. And we'll return now to Barnum's portrait. Never one to shy away from publicity, Barnum arranged to have his response published in the Republican of March 20th, and here it is. "Gentlemen, I have the honor to acknowledge the receipt of a letter from you requesting me to deliver a temperance address in this city previous to my departure. I am afraid an overestimate of my services in the glorious cause of temperance has induced the request. At all events, I can but say that my services are at your command if you think they can be made productive of any good. I respectfully suggest Friday evening next as the time and the theater as the place. Truly yours, P.T. Barnum." On the night of March 21st, same day as the Butcher's Parade, same evening as the Butcher's Parade, the impresario held forth at Saul Smith's St. Louis Theater. The audience embraced a large portion of our most respectable and enlightened citizens, stated the Republican, who received the views of the speaker with evident marks of satisfaction. In his memoirs, Barnum claimed that his friend Saul Smith signed the pledge at the end of the evening. The following evening, many of these same citizens responded with enduring intemperance, financially speaking, filling Barnum's coffers with an additional $7,700 at Lynn's third performance, despite a steady rain. Although her contract required her to sing only 4 times on any given concert, the diva continued to be generous with the public, offering on this occasion many more pieces than 4. She sang "I Know That My Redeemer Liveth," an aria from Bellini's I Puritani. She also sang with Belletti, of course, the Adina Dulcamara duet from Donizetti's L'Elisir d'Amore. She sang Und ob die Wolke from Weber's Freischütz, Julius Benedict's ballad Take This Lute, and The Last Rose of Summer from von Flotow's Martha. In just 3 nights, Barnum had taken in an astounding $23,500, the modern equivalent of approximately $500,000. Convinced that his box office bonanza had yet to run its course, the impresario scheduled 2 additional performances for the following Monday and Wednesday, thereby affording Lynn 48 hours of vocal rest between concerts. In all his dealings with the songstress, Barnum seems to have acted with the utmost fairness and professional courtesy. As the Lynn engagement entered its second week, however, The public's enthusiasm began to wane a bit. The final two concerts, March 24th and 26th, netted $4,000 and $3,000 respectively, raising Barnum's total gross in St. Louis to over $30,600. That's well over $600,000 in the modern equivalent. Lynn's selections, March 24th, included Una Voce Poco Fa from Rossini's Barber and Henry Rowley Bishop's Home Sweet Home. Bishop's ballad, trotted out repeatedly and shamelessly by Adelina Patti and other prima donnas in later years, was destined to become one of the greatest hits of the 19th century concert stage. At the March 26th concert, Lynn, who left $2,000 of her earnings with the mayor of St. Louis for distribution to various charities, offered A Non Giunge from La Sonnambula by Bellini, as well as a repetition of the gypsy song from Meyerbeer's Camp in Silesia. Lynn and her troupe then left by steamer for Nashville immediately after the concert. Travel by river was the only way to go out in this part of the country. What was the nature of Lynn's voice and her popularity with American audiences? George Upton, who served as music critic at the Chicago Tribune for a quarter century, penned a fairly technical description of Lynn's vocal prowess. Here's what he said in his memoirs. Her voice was of full volume and extraordinary range, and had a peculiar penetrating quality also because of its purity, which made its faintest tone clearly audible and enabled her to use exquisitely soft pianissimos. Her high notes were as clear as a lark's, and her full voice was rich and sonorous. Her singing was genial and sympathetic, and marked by the fervor and devotional quality which characterized her nature. It evinced a noble musical endowment and great reverence for her art. She was little affected by adulation, but acknowledged the wild, frantic applause courteously and with evident pleasure. Not everyone was a Lynn enthusiast, however. No less a musical eyewitness than Walt Whitman was unmoved by her. This didn't quite come out. So what this is a daguerreotype, 1854, Library of Congress. With this early photographic process, the image is transferred to a light-sensitive, silver-coated metallic plate. Here's what Whitman said. The Swedish swan, with all her blandishments, never touched my heart in the least. I wondered at so much vocal dexterity, and indeed they were all very pretty, those leaps and double somersaults. But even in the greatest religious airs, genuine masterpieces as they are, executed by this strangely overpraised woman in perfect scientific style, let critics say what they like, it was a failure. For there was a vacuum in the head of the performance. Beauty pervaded it, no doubt, and that of high order. But it was the beauty of Adam before God breathed into his nostrils. Also noteworthy are the discerning comments of George C.D. O'Dell, that steadfast champion of Adelina Patti, the greatest soprano of the generation that succeeded Lynn's. Concerning reviews in the New York Herald of Jenny Lynn's second and third concerts in America, O'Dell made the following observations. This review is extraordinarily interesting, he says, stressing as it does the beauties in the upper register and showing the harshness of the lower. The break between the registers of that phenomenal voice is a matter of musical history, whereas the utter evenness throughout the registers was a distinguishing characteristic of the voice of Adelina Patti. Elsewhere, Odell remarked trenchantly, quote, Lynn had learned what the American public likes, brilliant coloratura combined with simple sentiment. Any discussion of Lynn's hold on the public should also take into account her reputation for generosity, a quality that Americans have always identified with, and one that Barnum ingeniously promoted. Of course, she could afford to be generous because she was getting $1,000 a performance with Barnum, and she gave 95 concerts, well, really 94 for money. The first one she offered gratis in New York. So that's $94,000, and you multiply that by 20, and that's a nice, tidy sum in today's dollars. With Barnum, then, she had reaped $2 million, more or less. That's not bad for a tour, and most of the singers in the audience would sell for that, wouldn't you? Nine months of work, $2 million, no income tax in those days. It seems proper that the final word on the Jenny Lind phenomenon should go to an anonymous representative of her vast audience. Midway through Lynn's St. Louis engagement, the Republican received the following unsigned testimony of her greatness. Quote, this is from the letter. Although I had been prepared to hear a cantatrice of wonderful powers, yet I was absolutely amazed at the almost superhuman tones which compelled me to restrain my breathing, lest I should lose a solitary sound of that voice whose melody alone, of all others which I have heard, led me to believe I was listening to an angel instead of a mortal. Science may speak of its powers, its compass, and its volume, but no language can possibly convey the most distant idea of the unearthly brilliancy. It must be heard in order to understand and appreciate its heavenly purity. Never in the whole course of my life have I witnessed the realization of the fabled powers of Orpheus as during her singing. After a highly lucrative year with Barnum, Lynn became convinced that she could be even more successful on her own. Late in the spring of 1851, she took advantage of an option in the contract and terminated her agreement with the impresario. Here is a ticket that is held by the State Historical Society of Missouri. It's from Philadelphia, June 9, 1851. This is the last concert that she gave under Barnum's wing. She resumed her tour, but without Barnum, her success was considerably diminished. In February 1852, 8 months after breaking with Barnum, Lynn married pianist Otto Goldschmidt in Boston. Goldschmidt, who had accompanied her several times in concerts in Germany and England, had joined the Lynn tour the previous spring of 1851. Lynn and her bridegroom then went into seclusion in Northampton, Massachusetts for 3 months, emerging in May 1852 to give 4 or 5 final concerts, with piano, of course, not with orchestra, in Northampton and New York City before sailing to Liverpool. Jenny Lind never returned to America. Here's an overview of her time spent stateside. She arrived September 1st, 1850. She gave her first concert, which, as I said earlier, was a charity event, very good publicity, very good marketing on the part of both of them, Castle Garden. March 18th, 26, 1851, she gets to St. Louis and gives 5 concerts in what's really 9 days. It's a lot of singing. June 9th, 1851, final concert under Barnum's wing in Philadelphia. Marries Otto Goldschmidt, February 5th, 1852. May 24th, her final concert in New York. And May 28th to 29th, she departed for Liverpool. Lind continued to concertize in Germany and England for a number of years. In 1883, roughly 30 years after her American tour, she accepted an appointment as a professor of voice at the Royal College of Music in London, a position she retained until a year before her death in 1887. She lived 67 years. A medallion of the singer is still on public view in Westminster Abbey. Concluding remarks. It would be easy to view the Lind engagement as simply a blip on the historical radar, a brief infusion of high art in the young nation, generating unparalleled profits, but lacking any far-reaching significance. But, as it happened, the Barnum-Lind partnership of 1850-51 permanently changed the course of the nation's musical landscape. For it demonstrated unequivocally that a market for major European artists existed in the American interior. Largely as a result of having been one of Lind's ports of call, Missouri would become one of the long-term beneficiaries of this new cultural direction, as would other states in the center of the nation. An equally groundbreaking aspect of the Barnum-Lind partnership is that Barnum, through clever publicity and marketing, was able to turn Lind into the first pop music celebrity, resulting in the appearance and commercialization of products bearing her name. For further reading, I would certainly recommend the Ware and Lockhart book. It's a wonderful account of her entire tour. Very detailed. Much of the information that I've used here is I found here. The contract there is quoted. It's all spelled out. In the appendix he has, they both give the entire itinerary, and as I recall, they give the box office receipts for each performance for these tours. I mentioned Rosenberg's memoirs. He was the British editor and writer who accompanied her on the tour. And there's more information in Harlan Jennings' article published in the Missouri Historical Review in January 2010. I believe that's it. Thank you very much for listening. I'll try to answer any questions you may have. Thank you. Dr. Hall.
Harlan, was Jenny Lind's voice ever recorded?
I'm afraid not, because her career was preceded the age of recordings and the ability. But I can give you a little more information. The famous London critic Henry Chorley, writing in 1862, about 10 years after her tour, when Lind was somewhat past her vocal prime, gave this assessment of her talent, which I just happen to have right here in front of me. We didn't plan this. I didn't know Don was going to ask that question. It can now, without treason, he says, be recorded that Mademoiselle Lind's voice was a soprano, two octaves in compass from D to D, having a possible higher note or two available on rare occasions, and that the lower half and the upper one were of two distinct qualities. This is that register break that's alluded to in the review of the New York Herald, which George C. D. Odell takes a great glee in pointing out, and then contrasting with Adelina Patti's voice. The former, that is, the lower half of the voice, was not strong, veiled if not husky, and apt to be out of tune. The latter was rich, brilliant, and powerful, finest in its highest portions. It can be told that the power of respiration was possessed by Mademoiselle Lind in the highest perfection, that she could turn her, he puts this in quotes, very long breath to account in every gradation of tone. Her execution was great. Her shake, in other words, her trill, was true and brilliant. Her taste in ornament was altogether original. On every note that she sang, in every bar that she delivered, a skilled and careful musician was to be detected. And I'll just add that the normally analytical Viennese critic, Edward Hanslick, regarded Lind as one of those, and I'm quoting him now, phenomena that approach the great manifestations of beauty in nature, before which one can only stand still and gratefully proclaim their existence. That's from Henry Pleasant's wonderful book, The Great Singers. So if you can impress Edward Hanslick, you had quite a feather in your cap. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Benjamin. This might be a bit of a far reach. Robert Schumann was perhaps one of the greatest music critics in Europe at this time, 1820s, 30s, 40s, until he was committed, of course. But did he have anything to say about Jenny Lind when she was touring in Europe?
Quite possibly, because she sang in Leipzig and Berlin. In fact, Meyer Beer, who was having operas produced in Berlin, was able to pull a few strings and get her an audition there and get her hired. And then A Camp in Silesia premiered in Berlin with Lind in the title role. She sang in Aachen, Stuttgart, Munich, very likely Vienna. I know she sang there, all over Germany, Paris, Copenhagen, of course, Stockholm. I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't cover her at one time or another. It would certainly make sense that he would have. Yes, Bakara. No, she did not. But it's that reminds me of something else. It's very interesting to compare her with Charlotte Bronte, the great novelist. They were both about the same age, and when Lynn came to St. Louis, she was single, and Bronte was single. They were both single women in the prime of life at this time and making their way in the world as creative artists. But Lind was reveling in a great adventure, her first American tour, and Bronte was living at Haworth Parsonage in Yorkshire with her father. And she was recovering from the recent deaths of her three remaining siblings, Branwell, Emily, and Anne, all of whom had died in 1848 and 1849. And Charlotte, while she was recovering, was writing her most pessimistic novel, Villette. Both would soon marry. Lind, as we know, went to Otto Goldschmidt in 1852, and Bronte, 2 years later, to Arthur Bell Nichols, a former curate there where her father held forth at the parsonage. But Bronte died then in March of 1855. In 1851, she just had 5 years to live. Lind continued to live for another 30 years. And to the best of my memory, Lind's marriage was successful, but I wouldn't swear to that in court. Don't take my word for it. Check Grove or someplace that really knows. Yeah.
Did they settle in England, or did they go back, or did she go back?
I think
she had any connection to Sweden anymore.
I'm sure she went back there occasionally, but she once she stopped singing operas, that was it. She never went back, but saved her voice for the concert platform, and I'm sure she revisited probably gave concerts in Sweden, but London, I think, was her base of operations from which she would go to the continent. Grove mentions concerts in England and Germany, but doesn't talk much about other places. Yes, Giovanna. A Camp in Silesia in Berlin, Meyerbeer's piece. Possibly others, I don't know. Her one of her big roles seems to have been in Robert the Devil. The role of Alice.
Don. Harlan, other than her exquisite voice, depending on your point of view, was she a fine actress in these operas as well? Is there any comment about her acting ability as an operatic role?
There probably is, and I'm not aware of it. Of course, acting styles were in constant flux, and what we regard as correct or natural acting may not have been in vogue at the time. Certainly, singing styles have changed quite a bit. And of course, my wife keeps pointing out to me, you have to take what any critic says with a certain grain of salt. It's just one person's opinion. So one critic would perhaps have chastised her for poor acting, and another one have found it quite acceptable. I will say that the critics are quite consistent in the United States in praising her voice. Ware and Lockard did not mention any reviews where she was savaged at all. It all seems to have been quite positive. And she was brilliantly handled by Barnum, and she was very careful in what she said when she was off camera, as it were. Very careful, and never seems to have offended anybody. What she really thought about St. Louis or some of these other places never got into print. Barnum was very, very smart, and she did what he told her to do.
Did Barnum ever sponsor another singer of what we call now classical music, stage of that sort again? Did he ever return to that sponsorship after Jenny Lind?
Again, I don't really know, but I don't recall any other sponsorship of a singer or any classical musician after the Lind tour. At some point, of course, he opened this his museum there in New York City and operated that with fairly consistent success, although I think it burnt down once and he had to rebuild. I'm not, my memory is a bit hazy about that, not that I was there at the time, but I just don't remember what I've read that clearly. But I don't think he indulged himself in classical musicians after that. I don't think he headed up any theater tours, although he certainly got into the circus business.
Well, in that regard, do you maybe you mentioned this, but I failed to pick up on it. How did he hook up with her as such a wonderful promotion in his career? Did he sponsor her coming to this country or only after she came?
He had the publicity out there long before she came. Apparently, as I said, he'd never heard her sing. He'd never seen her. But she had earned quite a reputation in London, and there was that smash debut that she made in front of the king and queen, queen and Prince Albert. And so the explanation is he was a genius, and he saw an opportunity. So he jumped on a boat and sailed over there and signed her up, all the while publicizing that he was going over there and what he was going to do when he got there. So the publicity machine was working back home, and the thing was hyped to high heaven. And in St. Louis, the newspaper started covering her tour months before she showed up. And there was as you can imagine, a certain jockeying for position among the cities in the interior, because once she caught fire on the East Coast, any city of consequence wanted to bring her there. And she was going to be in America a limited amount of time. So it was a great honor to be chosen by Barnum for the tour. And when it was finally announced to the St. Louis public that, yes, St. Louis was going to be a winner, and this was in earlier mid-November of 1850, about a couple of months before she had debuted, then St. Louis just went mad. And the way they found out was that a reporter, a St. Louis reporter who was back east covering the tour and sending dispatches out constantly, happened to see a copy of Barnum's itinerary that hadn't been made public yet. And he spotted that and spilled the beans and sent a message out to St. Louis, and boom, it was in the papers, and everybody in St. Louis started jumping up and down, got really excited about it. Yes, Bernie.
So, before Barnum got involved with her and brought her into the United States to constitute, how well known, how widespread was her name and her reputation in the United States? Where was it? Or was Barnum the one who really elevated her?
I would say Barnum gets the credit for it. Yes, surely. There were any number of other sopranos who were doing quite well in Europe and in England during the 1840s and 50s. Most of them found their way to the States, but because they heard that you could make a lot of money in America, which was true, but they never enjoyed the success that Lynn did. Most of them came after Jenny Lind, wanting to copy her success. Naturally, history unfolded that way. I mentioned Henry Rowley Bishop's famous song, Home Sweet Home, from his Clary, which debuted at Covent Garden in 1823. His wife, Anna Bishop, was a very fine singer. She came to the States in the late 1840s for the first time, traveled everywhere, made quite a bit of money. She even got west of the Mississippi. She traveled out to Boonville, Missouri, and Independence, Missouri, in the heat of a July summer by stagecoach. You can imagine what that was like. She went upriver as far as the middle of Missouri. I can't recall the name of the town. Then got off on a stagecoach to get on out to Independence. And then she hit some other river town, St. Joe, and then turned around and went back to Hannibal and nearby Palmyra in the summer of 1850. And then eventually down the Mississippi and I'm sure either up to Ohio or down on down to New Orleans. But she toured everywhere, not just here. She was intrepid. She wound up in Australia, New Zealand. She went everywhere. She was, of course, she had divorced him by this time and run off with somebody else. But, of course, that helped her publicity, didn't it? But I guess I've answered your question. Barnum was by far the most successful promoter. These other guys who tried to do it were pikers compared to him. They just couldn't match him at all. Yeah, please.
If I can just ask one more related to this.
Since you're a neighbor, yeah. It's okay.
I guess what I was interested in was knowing how popular was the kind of music she was known for, opera and things of that. How popular was it in the United States, in the Boondocks?
That's okay. I grew up in Topeka, Kansas, so St. Louis is a big city.
But I'm wondering how popular was classical type music, opera, and the things that she sang aside from the more popular things she sang. Was it popular in the United States? Did Barnum have something to do with creating that by bringing her?
Yes and yes. Yes, it was popular, and it was in the culture, so that gave him a building base, but a lot of it was his doing. In 1821, the upright piano was invented or produced in Great Britain, and thereafter, every middle-class family that wanted to be regarded as cultured, or nearly everyone, would have one of these in the living room. And what would they play? Well, a lot of times they would play versions of arias from Italian operas or overtures. Often these arias had been simplified to make them more accessible to amateur singers, and translated, of course, into English. So there was that base here in this country, because in America we by and large imitated the British, and we still do. Unlike the Germans and the French and the Italians, we're fond of listening to singers sing in some foreign language that we cannot understand. And this goes all the way back to Handel's time in London, and probably before that. He was a German running an opera company in England that was featuring Italian singers who sang Italian opera in Italian. But that's England was the model for us, and so yes, it was there in the culture. And it was much more popular then than now, if you can imagine that, because there weren't all these other distractions. Nickelodeon hadn't come along yet. There wasn't film, there wasn't radio, there weren't movies, let alone computers and all these other things that command our attention. And there was a great deal of striving at this time towards the betterment of society. And especially in these towns in the Midwest, they wanted to prove to their compatriots in the East that they were just as cultured and appreciative of the fine things as those snooty Easterners were. And one of the ways you established your cultural credentials was by enjoying good music. And they were very interested in importing musicians of all kinds, not just singers. And once there was a network of railroads, of course, then it became much more feasible to do this, and professional troops of all kinds, concert groups as well as opera and theater companies, started to multiply and would give short seasons in New York and then go on the road. There was a rail line established across the north part of Missouri, of course, in 1859, which helped the Pony Express. Couldn't have had the Pony Express without that. The Pony Express started in April 1860. This line ran from Hannibal over to St. Joe. So these express riders riding in from the west would jump on a ferry and cross over to St. Joe with their mail packets, and then they could put those on a train. Running along at the unheard-of speed of 30 miles an hour. Reporters riding with Abraham Lincoln, for example, when he was going back to Washington from Springfield in 1861, reported the astonishing speed between Cincinnati and Columbus, Ohio, of average speed of 30 miles an hour on the train. But with the Golden Spike, in 1869, out in Utah, then you had a ribbon of rail running from coast to coast. And it was now much easier for these troops to get out to San Francisco, and where there was a lot of money because of the gold fields. And, of course, along the way, they would want to replenish the treasuries or add to them, wouldn't they? So they would make stops in any town where they thought they might make a buck, like Omaha or Lincoln, or swing down to Denver from Cheyenne, et cetera. Yes, sir, Professor Hall.
Well, just my last, and I'll shut up. My last question is, at the height of this interest in culture in the Midwest, in the terms you described tonight, and this is an area of your research interest, how many would you estimate Midwestern towns of all sizes had what I've seen called opera houses?
Nearly all of them had what was euphemistically known as an opera house.
How many would you say?
Nearly every city or town of any decent size. That doesn't mean that operas went on there. But especially towards the latter decades of the 19th century and on into the early decades of the 20th, because of the association in the minds of many religious people of theaters with prostitution and drinking, and some of this connection was not too far off base. There was this long period of time when you were better off, if you were a theater manager, to call your place an opera house. And that meant that respectable people could go there. One of the things that happened, I've forgotten which decade, but the 1850s or the 1860s in St. Louis was the creation of matinees. They were copying what had happened back east. But a matinee then was something that women could go to unaccompanied by a gentleman. In the evening, there was a rule that no single woman could come in because they were afraid that they would make assignations up in the balcony, etc. In other words, you get the idea. So matinees then were an okay place, respectable thing, and women and children could go to the matinees and preserve their reputations. But the opera houses were everywhere. In my native state, every small town of probably 4,000 or 5,000 people had one of these things at one time. They may never, ever have had an opera performance there. But many of them did. They just weren't the frontline companies from New York City. There were a number of regional companies that sprang up. The Chicago Church Choir Company was in vogue for a while, and they made a killing touring with Gilbert and Sullivan operas all over the country. But the rail lines were essential. And once you had that, then you had a fairly accessible, easy way of transportation across the country. Yeah, Peggy.
You mentioned at the end that P.T. Barnum was good at marketing Jenny Lind's name with various products. What were some of the products?
Well, I'm not really answering your question, but I will. I don't think he had anything to do. He got no cut. He had nothing to do with the marketing of the products. Other people took advantage of this, and she got no residuals from it. She received none. But somebody would get the idea of, as we heard in the piece, manufacturing Jenny Lind flour. They didn't get her approval to do it. They just did it. I mean, in those days, you could get away with that. You didn't. There weren't copyright laws, and so they did. And then, of course, as things evolved, then we reached the point where we had endorsements, as we have now, and people wised up about this and hired agents, et cetera, and went to court, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think she ever realized a nickel from this. But she didn't need to. She had really cleaned up, thanks to Barnum. Yes, sir.
So, knowing what I know about Walt Whitman, I was curious, who So I'm just curious, like, can we really trust what he says about a female singer?
He's certainly entitled to his opinion, and I think his sexual orientation probably had very little to do with it. Many critics over the years have been, I would say, gay, and to use a term in rather common parlance, but I don't think that has any influence on their ability to judge performances and performers. Some critics are just better than others. Some are very, some you would agree with nearly 95% of the time, but they can certainly be off base. And maybe Jenny Lind reminded him in some subconscious level of that ornery niece that he had. And so he pens a rather uncomplimentary review. I'm just making that up. But who knows why critics will be critical of one singer and not another. I do know this, if you go to judge, let's say you're on a panel with four other judges, and you go hear a performance of a singer, we'll say at Orchestral Hall in Chicago, you're going to get five different opinions, four at variance with yours, regarding the quality of that performance. That's just the general cussedness, some might say, of human nature. So I don't think it influenced. He just didn't like her singing that much. Apparently he preferred somebody who sang with what he would have regarded as more passion and less embellishment and ornamentation. It sounds as if he regarded her as a music box of some kind, a bit like the doll in Tales of Hoffman, perhaps. Who knows? He just didn't like her. But there's, I'm sure she was a wonderful singer, but not his cup of tea. Yes, he did, but I'm not familiar with that, and I'm afraid you'd need to consult some other source. There may be professors in this room who know the answer to that question, but I'm afraid I don't. Thank you very much.